Our text this week, as we continue our series through what's called Zechariah's Night Visions, is Zechariah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8. You're probably tired of me rehearsing this with you, but I'm going to keep doing it because I would hate for us to miss what is being pointed out by the structure of these visions. If you recall, they parallel each other, right? They form the reason it's called a chiasm is because it's like the Greek letter that's shaped like an X. The themes kind of come together like this. If they were to continue, it would look like an X. So you have a theme here, a theme here, a theme here, a hinge, and then the same themes repeat on the way out to show you how to handle these things because of the hinge and how important that is. So now we're back to paralleling the very first vision that we read about, the one that showed all the chaotic powers of the world and how the reason Israel was being, they were being terrible ambassadors, as it were, back in their homeland to build God's kingdom is because they were full of fear and doubt, which turned into selfishness, not trusting in God to do what he said he would do. So instead of building the temple, they built their own houses instead. And God is sending them these visions to tell them, you have no reason to fear or doubt. Build my kingdom. It will last. It will win. What I promise to you cannot fail to come to pass. And so in that first vision, he showed them, my horsemen are patrolling the earth. They're bringing me the report of what's going on and how the world in rebellion against me is arrogantly causing you to suffer. I'm sovereign over all that. You've got nothing to fear. Well, now we're back to that theme again. We went from that to zooming in. He's like, the world's not your issue. Zoom in a little closer to home. Why aren't things happening right at home? Well, we can't. We're being persecuted. So God said, those powers are nothing to worry about. I've got that taken care of. Zoom a little closer to home here in Zion, Jerusalem. Why is the kingdom not being built? Well, you're not hoping in the right thing. You need a new Zion. That's where your hope's got to be set, one that no earthly thing can touch. And they rightly say, well, then how can we enter that? And there's the hinge. Because of what takes place in the throne room of God, as Satan's there to accuse us, God says, no, I will not listen. Not because they're not guilty, but because I said I'm saving them from the fire they deserve. And if you got a problem with that accuser, you have a problem with me. I'm reclothing them. And if their high priest is clothed in perfect clothing, he represents all of them. So are they. Therefore, go rebuild that city knowing you've got my favor. Rebuild that temple. But no, it's a picture of a greater temple. But then he reminded them, if you're just in here along for the ride as a bunch of false professors here in the land of Israel, you won't stay in the land of Israel. You'll go back to Babylon. I did this for you to change you. If you're just falsely professing, you have no place in my people. So now we're back out to the world again. And we're wondering, okay, well, the reason we struggle with all this, the reason you said we might get taken back to Babylon is because we keep listening to the world's temptations, and when we don't give in, the world then threatens us. How much longer is this to go on? How can we bear up under these things? And so God gives us reasons today why we can count on him being victorious over the lure of the world, but also the threats of the world when we don't do what they want. He is going to be victorious over them, both inside us and outside of us. Hear now the word of the Lord. Zechariah chapter 6, verse 1. Again, I lifted my eyes and saw, behold, four chariots came out from between two mountains, and the mountains were of bronze. The first chariot had red horses, the second black horses, the third white horses, and the fourth chariot dappled horses, all of them strong. Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, what are these, my Lord? And the angel answered and said to me, these are going out to the four winds of heaven after presenting themselves before the Lord of all the earth. The chariot with the black horses goes toward the north country. The white ones go after them. The dappled ones go toward the south country. When the strong horses came out, they were impatient to go and patrol the earth. And he said, go, patrol the earth. So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried to me, behold, those who go toward the north country have set my spirit at rest in the north country. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids, if you're here with us today or if you're at home, remember a couple weeks ago I talked to you about how sometimes parents care so much about protecting their kids that sometimes they might even get a little too concerned Remember I told you that story about when I was wheeling my little baby girl down the road and the dog came out barking and baring its teeth, and my first thought was, I might have to kill the dog. That was a little over the top, wasn't it? But that's how much I wanted to protect my little girl, right? Well, I remember another time, there were some kids over our house, and it's no one from this church, so no one started looking around the room. And one of those kids was kind of being mean to one of my kids. And I heard my kid say, stop, and the other kid wouldn't stop. Stop, and the other kid wouldn't stop. Please stop, and the other kid kept doing this. And I thought, maybe I should go in and take a look. So I walked in the room, and that other kid didn't see me right away. And they were on the floor doing what they were, crawling after my kid, trying to get them. And then the kid said, stop. And all of a sudden, I kind of made a sound with my foot. And that kid looked up and saw me. And what do you think he did? He ran really fast out of the room. Because I wasn't going to let anyone pick on my kids. And then my kids were fine. It wasn't a big deal. But I thought I should go in and make sure they're being kept safe. And God, our Father, loves you way more than your parents love you, even more than I love my kids. Even though I know your parents really love you and I really love my kids, God loves all of us who trust in Jesus even more than that. His people in this verse were afraid of what the rest of the world might do to them because they weren't going to worship what the world said they should worship. They were only going to worship God. And sometimes people might not be very kind to you for worshiping God and doing the right thing when they want you to do the wrong thing with them. And sometimes it's going to be easy to want to give in to what they want so that they aren't mean to you or so that they like you and they think you're cool. And sometimes it's hard to do the right thing or stand up for what God wants you to stand up for. But what God reminds us of here is that just like I came in when my child was being hurt and I made sure her dad's here, God reminds his people, I'm always with you, and no one is going to take you away from me. Wouldn't that be a scary thing if people could take you away from Jesus? If they could take heaven away from you? That'd be pretty scary, wouldn't it? God promises us nobody can take it away. You know what? Even you can't lose it when you mess up and sin. Because why does God let us into heaven? Why does he love us and forgive us in the first place? Because of what Jesus did, right? And nobody can take that away. And once you trust in Jesus, God never lets you go. He'll always love you and forgive you, and he'll bring you home. So when people are mean to you about these things, if they make fun of you for being someone who loves God and wants to do the right thing, you don't need to be mean back. You don't need to be fearful. You can just be kind to them and know, I know God sees this, and he's not going to stop loving me or take away my hope. Jesus won that for me. So can you think of ways that maybe you can be kind to people and show them the love of Jesus when they maybe are not kind to you? Okay, thank you guys for listening. So, we're paralleling the first vision again. While we do not need to be afraid of those powers of the world that seek to destroy the hope of the Christian. And ultimately that comes down to, well, how can we be assured of victory over sin? Because our old nature within and the world without both are dragging us away from the calling we've been given. What's the calling we've been given? To be ambassadors for the kingdom, to be building, as it were, God's house and not giving up on that mission in fear of the world, in selfishness, and just settling for what's easy and what's not offensive, what's acceptable by the world's standards so that no one does wrong by me, so I can be accepted by their standards and so I can have an easy life. It's very easy to give in to all the currents that are pushing us that direction. How can we instead be assured of victory over sin so we can be the ambassadors God's called us to be? First, God cares more about this than you do. And I hope that's a comforting thought to you. God cares more about this victory over sin than you do. Second, he promises both the inward and the outward victory over sin that we desperately need. He promises both the inward and the outward victory we desperately need. And third, why can we be assured of victory over sin? Because all of this is part of his sovereign plan. All of this is part of his sovereign plan. So first, we can be assured in this battle, or as I mentioned earlier, that this race we're running will be finished. It will be completed. It's not a waste, because God cares more about you finishing this race than you do. That's not meant to be a slap in the face, saying, well, I know you don't care, but at least God does. No, I think you do care. I don't think you'd be here with a mask on today if you didn't. And I don't think you'd be watching at home on a Sunday either if you didn't care. I know none of us, and apart myself in particular, does care enough, though, or in the right way. And we can be assured that we're not finishing this race if we just care enough or work enough or put in enough effort. We're going to finish because God is passionate about protecting us and bringing us across that finish line. So what are the things that keep you from being an effective ambassador for God's kingdom? Or in the analogy of this text here, as we've been repeating here, what makes you go just give up and build your own house and not care? Well, at the end of the day, it's the self-worship of sin, and that's going to look different for every one of us. It's the self-worship caused by sin. It's the fear and doubt that arises from failing to trust God's promises. If we truly trust in who he said we are and what he has planned for us, then nothing matters more to us than his glory. Nothing matters more to us than being an ambassador to others of that good news. So how can we get the hope and the confidence we need to fight against these tendencies that drive us into ourselves instead of out, ministering to each other in his family and then to the world that doesn't know him? Well, we have this picture here in this first vision of God's mighty edict going forth as his chariots come out from between these two mountains of bronze. And that's a common ancient Near Eastern picture. Often gods were depicted as between two mountains. God actually depicts himself as between different things fairly often in his imageries and different visions that he sends through his prophets. Often he'll be between cherubim or between images of the sun and the spirit. Here he's between these two mountains of bronze because the chariots are coming forth from his throne. Scholars have argued, and I think persuasively, that these are probably to be reminders of the two enormous bronze pillars that guarded essentially the entrance to the temple. If you recall the visions of the Son of Man, who is God, a picture of the pre-incarnate Christ in all his glory in Daniel, in both times you see him, he says his legs were like burnished bronze. I think some other scholars have argued persuasively that those enormous temple pillars are supposed to be a reminder of the mighty legs of God, as it were, that he's here. This is his palace, and none may enter except those he permits. And so often when God depicts himself as in a vision between these different things, for whatever reason, that often is a theme where he is announcing a rival to be with his people. I can't give you a reason for why, but it seems to be a recurrent theme. When God is set between things and presenting himself to his people that way, often what follows is promises of his coming to his people. And so he does this through his chariots that are riding forth from his throne room on his mission that he sent them on. Again, remember the parallel vision in chapter 1. The horses were out there patrolling the earth, and their report came back. The world is at ease, and they are oppressing the people of God, and God said, that is nothing to fear. I am sovereign over that. Well, now we hear something better. He's not just sovereign over what they're doing. He's actually promising something that's going to come into fuller vision next week in kind of the summary of all of these visions we've seen, a future involving the world that I don't think any Israelite could have possibly imagined. And I'd suggest, even though we have a far clearer understanding of what God's kingdom is than what the Israelites would have had, it's far beyond our comprehension as well. If you recall in the first vision, when the horsemen have given their report, the captain of that regiment, the captain of the horsemen, the captain of the armies of the Lord, as it were, was the angel of the Lord. And I told you then, and I'll remind you again now, that's always a clue that we're talking about the Christ pre-incarnate, the second person of the Trinity, before he was born of Mary, taking on these images to reveal whatever God wanted to reveal in those moments. If you recall in that first vision, after that report and hearing of the suffering of the people of God, the people weren't crying out, "How long?" Christ, the captain of the Lord's army there, said, "How long? How long till we get to redeem them and protect them and set things right?" And he again is still going to be the captain of the Lord's army. And we need to remember that. Before the people even had a chance to cry out, "How long?" Who's crying it out for them? The Christ. The one who's going to accomplish our redemption for us. And again, that's a reminder. Who is caring more about this than you? God. And I hope that's a comforting thought to you. Remember the pivotal vision of all this, when Satan's there to accuse Joshua, who rebukes the devil? It's not Joshua. Joshua hasn't had a chance to get a word out in his own defense before the devil even gets his words out. God says, "How dare you? The Lord rebuke you. I have snatched him from the fire." Joshua hadn't even had a chance to mutter a word. God cared so much more about his fate than Joshua did. And so if you recall, in the second vision, when God zoomed in a little bit closer and said, "It's not just the world and it's chaos and it's evil. They're specifically persecuting you for worshiping me." And at the end of that vision, God said, "Be silent, all flesh, before the Lord, for he has aroused himself from his holy dwelling." I gave you the visual back then of the Lord of the Rings there in the Mines of Moria when they accidentally dumped the bucket down the well, and all of a sudden you hear this drum beat in the deep and it begins to rumble and they all wonder, "What have we awoken?" If you've not seen the movie or read the book, I won't spoil it, but this ought to strike terror in the hearts of any who would be opposing the people of God. "Be silent, all flesh. I have roused myself from my holy dwelling. God is coming." And it's far more frightening for those who would be his enemy than anything in the deeps of Moria. Israel was not saying, "Bring it on, world. We have armed ourselves for anything you have." Now, they were cowering, building their own houses, and God was the one saying, "They can't defend themselves, so I'll defend them for my own glory." We see this picture again as the troops are assembled here. The horses, the text goes out of its way to say they're strong horses, are impatient to patrol the earth, impatient to go accomplish God's mission to protect and redeem his people. Now, we're allowed to cry out, "How long?" to the Lord. We just sung last week. It's one of my favorite songs we sing. Every year we thought was wasted, every night we cried, "How long?" will be a passing moment in our Savior's victory song. But the psalmist cries out, "How long?" to the Lord, showing that's a sinless, inspired prayer. You can pray that too. But we can't pray it impatiently. We can't cry out to the Lord saying, "How long?" while staring at our watch, tapping our feet, and rolling our eyes, sighing, wondering when in the world God's going to get his act together and realize that I deserve better than what I'm going through. We have to cry out, "How long?" humbly, patiently, awaiting God's timing. But God can cry out, "How long?" and not have to have any patience. There's no humility he has to have at all when it comes to executing his mission. And we see his troops here with righteous impatience, like the saints in Revelation saying, "How long do you avenge our blood?" We see this is a picture of God caring more about what you are going through than you do. When your old nature is tempting you and you are fighting it and you're weary, God is far more angered about what that old nature is doing than what you are. When you are mocked and persecuted by family or acquaintances or even those who are dug in enemies against Christ for your faith, as much as that hurts you, God is far more incensed that you are going through that than you are. When the devil dares to lie to you and accuse you that you are one that God cannot love or will not love, that your efforts are in vain, remember the pivotal image of the throne room. That's why it's pivotal. God was outraged, would not listen to one word the devil had to say. Not because we're so righteous, but because God has said, I did all the work necessary to protect them from the wrath they deserve. So how dare you say there's any left? So when you are tempted to despair because of the oppression you feel from those three forces that are always lying to us, always oppressing us, sometimes threatening us, remember that God sees what's going on better than you do. And in a way that I don't want to sound heretical and taking away his perfection, there are ways that I would suggest it would hurt him, even though he can't be damaged, he can't be hurt the way that we are. Ways that he is more passionate about defending you than you are. And we should lean on his promises for our hope and our defense and not somehow try to fashion together our own weapons and our own defenses for things we don't have the power in ourselves to defend against. God's plan is already made to redeem you. The necessary work to redeem you and bring you home has already been done. We're only awaiting God's perfect timing for when it all happens. So we need to take strength from the fact that these things are already assured and already accomplished, so we have the strength we need to face the battle that's at hand. Because though it's difficult, if we remember that the work's already done, we know we're going to win. That God will not give up on us, and that our faith cannot be lost. So God assures you of victory over sin because he cares more about the battle you're in than you do. But second, he promises both the inward and outward victory that we desperately need. So in verse 4, after seeing these horses, Zechariah said, "Then I answered and said to the angel who talked with me, 'What are these, my lord?' And the angel answered and said to me, 'These are going out to the four winds of heaven, after presenting themselves before the Lord of all the earth. The chariot with the black horses goes toward the north country, the white ones go after them, and the dappled ones go toward the south country.'" Now, I don't know if that caught your eye at all, but were you wondering about who's taking care of east and west? It said they came from the four winds of heaven. That's a picture of, again, all directions of the compass. You'd think, well, that's where they came from. That's where they were reported. Aren't they going to go back to those same directions to take care of everything? But instead, the horses only go north, and they only go south. Why do you think that is? Well, if you picture Israel's topography, to the west is the Mediterranean Sea. To the east is the desert. Now, if you cross that desert, you do get to Babylon, okay? But any time Israel had attackers, because of the sea, because of the desert, because of the different mountain ranges, they came from the south or they came from the north. Egypt always came from the south. Why would they come in the other direction? Babylon, also Assyria, and then later on Medes and Persians, the desert was too dangerous to cross. You're not going to make it. You went around from the north and came down that way. And Babylon is often referred to, particularly in Jeremiah, as the land of the north. Even if you look on the map, it's technically east. But where do they come from? They always come from the north. And so these two enemies are often representative throughout the scriptures. Egypt, if you look at the role Egypt plays in the life of Israel, often she is representative of self-reliance. Trusting in what man can do, trusting what self can provide, and not in the promises of God. I mean, look at what happens. They aren't even a couple of weeks out yet from being freed by, from being slaves, until they're already wanting to go back. Why? We had all those leeks and onions back there. We didn't have to trust God for our food. It was right there. Out here in the desert, we have to trust God. Well, he's actually given us a physical manifestation we get to look at. There's the pillar of fire by day, by cloud by day. There's the pillar of fire by night. He rains food down from us every day. But I'd rather go back to Egypt than be a slave, because at least then I don't have to trust. At least then it's sure, it's containable, it's observable. I know the parameters there. It feels safer. The text goes out of its way often in the story of Abraham and Hagar to constantly call her Hagar from Egypt, Hagar the Egyptian, Hagar the Egyptian. What is the story of Hagar and Abraham if not a story of self-reliance, right? God had just given Abraham in chapter 15 this amazing promise. With the sign of him walking through the dead animals, saying, "The blood is on me. I'm keeping the covenant for you. If you fail, the blood comes on me, not you." You are so sure in this stuff. And the very next chapter is like, "Well, I guess I better have a slave through my wife's maidservant Hagar, because otherwise I'd have to trust God to give us kids and we're too old." And you're like, "Really? Seriously, Abraham?" Hagar the Egyptian, Hagar the Egyptian. And we see this throughout Israel's history, both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, in the face of often Assyria's threats. Instead of relying on the Lord, they go to Egypt to try to make deals with them, to maybe get some military help from them. They end up being Egypt's vassals as a result, with Egypt running the show by the end before Babylon comes and wipes them out. Egypt is this picture of relying on man, relying on self, and not on the promises of God throughout the Old Testament. This is a picture of that inner battle that we face. And God sent his forces south to destroy that temptation to rely on man and on self. And we need to hear that, because that's the root of just about all of our sin. One of these days, this battle against that annoying old nature that says you don't need God's grace will be over. And we've already heard great words from Paul to this very effect in Romans chapter 8, after he talks about the difficult battle against our old nature in Romans 7. "Wretched man that I am, who's going to deliver me from this body of death?" He says, "Thanks be to God in Jesus Christ, there's no condemnation." And what's the result of no condemnation in Christ and being given the Spirit of the living Christ? Beginning in Romans 8:5, Paul says, "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. For the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile to God, for it does not submit to God's law. Indeed, it cannot. Those who are in the flesh cannot please God. You, however, are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if in fact the Spirit of God dwells in you. Anyone who does not have the Spirit of Christ does not belong to him. But if Christ is in you, although the body is dead because of sin, the Spirit is alive because of righteousness. If the Spirit of him who raised Jesus from the dead dwells in you, he who raised Jesus from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies through his Spirit who dwells in you. So then, brothers and sisters, we are debtors not to the flesh to live according to it. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are sons of God. For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the Spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father." There's a lot packed in that passage, but what is Paul saying? All who have believed have been raised from the dead. What raised you from the dead? The same Spirit that raised Christ from the dead. That same Spirit that raised him from the dead is in you, getting rid of more and more of the old nature and in vivifying more and more of your new nature by reflecting on the fact that there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ. So reflection on the gospel gives us that power to turn back the old nature. Picture God's forces riding south to shut down that tempter Egypt to say, rely on self, not God's promises. And the gospel being the force that shuts that down. Meditate on it more. Beg God to remind you of it more. Ask him through his Spirit to remind you, you are not a slave to fear. You don't have to rely on self. You have access to God as sons. And why sons, ladies? Because the sons were heirs, and so are you. That's why we don't have to give in to self and rely on self. So when you hear your old nature saying, rely on yourself, you don't need the grace of God. Beg him. Beg the Lord to shut that down and say, no, there's nothing greater I could ask for. Or maybe even more duplicitous, maybe even more deceitful for us. Rely on yourself. God's grace isn't enough. That's probably where more of us fall. I think all of us here would say we need God's grace. But I think many of our lives would depict that it's not something we view as truly enough. Yes, I need God's grace, but I also need these things to fall in line if I'm going to be at peace, if I'm going to be satisfied, if I'm going to really rest in him. I don't know what those things would be for you. I have a fraction of an idea of what they probably are for me. Egypt results in slavery every time. Does not let you live the life of a free heir that gets to call God Abba. The gospel gives that to you. Don't turn back on self. But Babylon is the land to the north. And while I focus there on the battle to the south, Babylon is the real focus of this vision. What had just happened in the previous vision? God said, if you're a false professor of believing in me and you're actually going to still keep robbing me of what you owe me, and you're not going to actually seek to keep my covenant, I'm taking you back to Babylon where you belong, because that's really where your heart's set. And why would your heart be set there? Because Babylon is often a picture of worldly pleasure and glorying in humanity. Not so much self-reliance like Egypt, but I'm not relying on self to achieve anything. I'm just giving in to pleasure. I'm saying, yes, man is the measure of all things. And just remember the statue in the vision of Daniel. What was the golden head on the top? Babylon. And again, it's the site of the original Tower of Babel, where man sought to make a monument to themselves and not do as God had commanded. It's been doing this for millennia. And this is the greater focus of this vision, because who's been oppressing them? It's the people of the north. Now, it's no longer the Babylonians. Now it's the Medes and the Persians, but it's still that concept. They're coming from Babylon. They had conquered Babylon. And it's the idea of, let's allure you with the pleasures of this world, with the gods of this world that we worship, with all sorts of earthly and immoral activity to worship those gods. Oh, by the way, if you don't give in to the temptation, then we threaten you and we force you and we persecute you. And that's very much the picture of our battle without, I often say to you, the battle outside of us, the powers of the world and the devil. As they tempt us and lure us, and the more we try to dig in and be faithful to the Lord, the temptations turn to threats. The temptations turn to persecution. Instead of, being lured by pleasure, we're now frightened by what it might mean if we're rejected by these forces, if we don't have their approval. And things might be going this direction in our country. We might face much more actual persecution than we ever have. If that's the case, we need to take great comfort from what we see God say here. The battle against these forces is hard. And if currently you don't find it hard, I will humbly suggest to you that it's probably because you're not fighting very hard. And I don't have any evidence of I know when I saw you not fight hard. I've never witnessed any of you give into the world, okay? But I know I do, and I know you do. It might not even take the form of physical manifestations and actions. It might just be crippling anxiety and fear and idolatry of the world's approval that just decays in our souls and doesn't take the form of actions that each other could spot. This battle is hard, and this is what God was reacting against. How long are they going to tempt my people and persecute them for not giving in to the sinful actions and the idolatrous worship they want them to participate in? And you have to wonder, as they were wondering, is there no rest? God, you just told us that if we are giving into these things, we're getting sent back to Babylon, and we don't want to get sent back to Babylon. We want to follow you, but is there no rest from the kind of mockery and oppression, if you go read the Ezra Nehemiah story, that they were receiving for trying to rebuild the temple and the wall? It was incessant. They didn't let up. And this world, till your dying day, will not let up on you either. Just get ready for it. Remember the vision at the beginning of the captain of the Lord's army, the Christ, astride his battle horse, rattling his saber, saying, "How long?" Take comfort in that. He is readying his army to come to your rescue, to prevent you from ever falling, to prevent anyone from ever taking away your hope. And he does that by reminding us here in his third plan. This is all a third point. This has all been part of his sovereign plan. None of these persecuting forces have ever taken him by surprise. This is all his story he's written. And your part in it is particularly tailored to you and all he's gifted you with and how he's designed you so you can be an ambassador for his kingdom the way he's called you to. In verse 7, we see, "Then the strong horses came out, and they were impatient to go patrol the earth. And he said, 'Go patrol the earth.' So they patrolled the earth. Then he cried to me, 'Behold, those who go toward the north country have set my spirit at rest in the north country.'" Go back to the kids' sermon, where this child was being mean to my child, and they didn't know I was standing right there. And once they realized it, they fled. God is saying, "I know where your oppression's coming from. I know what the world's trying to get you to do. I know how they're persecuting you. And I have just sent my forces north, and they've brought my spirit to sit down right there in the middle of where all this is coming from. They think I don't see it, but I do. And I'm shutting it down. The promises I made to you, they will not thwart. The promises I made to you will come to pass. You will be successful in building this temple. You will be successful in rebuilding the city and its wall." And that's the down payment he gives to all of us, reminding us that the gates of hell will not prevail against the spiritual kingdom we are building, because its temple is Christ. And nothing can defeat him. And what he needed to do to win that victory, he's already done. We're just waiting him to bring us the rest of the spoils. This is basically unpacking what God promised us all the way back in the Garden of Eden. When Adam and Eve are there, ready to be exiled east, just as Israel was exiled east to Babylon for their sin against God, in their despair, in their fear of what life was going to be like, what does God tell them? "The seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent." This is just one more puzzle piece of how all that's going to happen. All the work he began by rebelling in heaven and then inciting rebellion on earth against God will be undone. And not just undone. Not just back to zero. It's going to be made right. It's been a long time since I've watched it, so there may be something objectionable in it. So I'm not telling you all to go watch this movie. I remember loving it in college. But the classic Western Tombstone, if you recall, the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday are fighting kind of the Western version of the mob, the cowboys. And Wyatt Earp has lost brothers and friends, and they've killed so many people. And the band trying to fight them is growing weary, and Doc Holliday reminds them that Wyatt Earp's got a plan. And he says, "Make no mistake about it, it's not revenge he's after, it's a reckoning." It's a goosebump line every time I hear it. What does he mean by that? He's not just going to get them back. He's going to make things right. And that's what our God is promising here. I'm not just going to go hold Babylon at bay somehow I'll try not to let them get by, but hopefully you guys will be able to build while I do that. I am setting things straight. This is much bigger than just you building this earthly temple and city. It's a picture of God putting his spirit here wherever any attacking forces would be that would try to shut down his kingdom. And none of them will be able to succeed. His spirit is dwelling in the heart of where all the oppression is coming from. Remember the taunts God has had towards the oppressing voices throughout this whole letter. "I have roused myself, be silent flesh, I'm coming." Or when he says in chapter 4, "What are you, mountain? Before the hands of Zerubbabel, you're going to become a plain. You are nothing. Nothing's going to get in the way of what I've empowered my people to do. Remember, as I told you, the visions here are very dependent upon the visions in Daniel chapter 7 of all these different beasts rising up out of the chaotic waters, crushing and devouring both each other and those who would be the people of God. And then the Ancient of Days shows up, and they're silent, and he opens his books to judge them, and it's done. Remember these pictures. This is what's, again, mentioned in this very understated statement of, I've set my spirit to dwell there. Doesn't sound like much, but what does it mean? It means it's a picture of shutting down, just as mighty as it is in Daniel 7, as it is here. As it is in Revelation 11. After all the prophecies of what the different forces of evil are going to try to be doing to the people of God, in Revelation 11, 15, we hear this glorious announcement. Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. And the 24 elders who sat before God on their thrones fell on their faces and worshiped God, saying, we give you thanks, O Lord God Almighty, the one who is and the one who was and the one who is to come, because you have taken your great power and you have reigned. That's what's awaiting you. When we finish this race, as we sung earlier today, that's how it's going to end. As bad as you have fallen in the past, I hate to break it to you, you're probably going to fall in the future in ways you didn't think you would. And you're struggling now against sins that beset you. None of those things, nor any other accusations that may come your way, nor any persecution that may come your way, can take away the end of that story that's promised there. The kingdoms of this world will all be subdued and become the kingdoms of God's Christ, and he will reign forever and ever. What does that reign look like? What can we look forward to? Isaiah chapter 11 gives us maybe one of the greatest pictures we could ask for. In Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1, God promises us this. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots, a branch will bear fruit. The spirit of the Lord will rest on him. The spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the spirit of counsel and of might, the spirit of the knowledge and fear of the Lord. And he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. With the breath of his lips he will slay the wicked. Righteousness will be his belt, and faithfulness the sash around his waist. The wolf will live with the lamb. The leopard will lie down with the goat, the calf and the lion, and the yearling together, and a little child will lead them. The cow will feed with the bear. Their young will lie down together, and the lion will eat straw like the ox. The infant will play near the cobra's den, and the young child will put his hand into the viper's nest. They will neither harm nor destroy on all my holy mountain, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. In that day, the root of Jesse will stand as a banner for the peoples. The nations will rally to him, and his resting place will be glorious. Why is this a hope for people like you and me? Because it's all accomplished by the branch, which we're going to focus on next week in the final vision. He delighted in the fear of the Lord, and because he delighted in it, you are credited with delighting in it as well. Because he did all things with faithfulness and righteousness, God looks at you as though you are faithful and righteous. And if he's given you that inheritance, he will listen to no voice that says, he can't treat you that way. That's why he's going to actually judge you with justice at the end. Justice that says, if they've been credited righteous as Christ, no voice saying otherwise is correct. It's actually unjust for God to reject someone who's been covered with Christ. So he will judge you saying, it is right for you to enter heaven because I have given you Christ's righteousness like it's your own. So enter. This is yours. Not because of what you've done, because of what the branch, the stump of Jesse, the son of David, the seed of the woman has done in crushing the head of the serpent and giving you hope, guaranteeing you victory from the sin within and the sin without. His spirit has come to rest in the land of the north. His spirit has come to rest with you because the spirit of the risen Christ is in you, allowing you to remember that you are one who gets to call God Abba, Father.